Welcome to the Sunbury Press Book Show on the BookSpeak Network. Sunbury Press publishes print, electronic, and audiobooks under a variety of imprints and categories, available worldwide wherever books are sold. And now your host, the founder and CEO of Sunbury Press, Lawrence Knorr.
We're at the Christian Baker Farm near historic Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania. My guest today is Michael E. Fox. He's the author of Lou, The Life and Times of the Author of Ben-Hur, an analytical and deeply rich historical biography of a great American author who is little known or remembered today. Lew Wallace, a fascinating and multi-talented historical figure, has consistently been overlooked and lost in academia, articles, and modern books. When he has been discussed, he has often been misrepresented and misunderstood. This is partly due to the sordid and profoundly controversial period in the United States during his lifetime. Yet Lew wrote one of the most successful and influential novels of the 19th century. The story he created and the high-profile controversies he was intimately involved in have lived on in numerous movies and television programs. Considered by many the most religiously influential novel of the 19th century, it has been said Ben-Hur has brought millions to their feet to cheer and millions more to their knees to pray. However, Ben-Hur, A Tale of the Christ, is not primarily a story of Christ, but more a thinly veiled chronicle of Lew's life and times he lived, set over 2,000 years in the past. The reader will be amazed how many of the same issues and controversies in Rome and Judea in 0 AD existed from 1827 to 1880 and still exist today. Lew, The Life and Times of the Author of Ben-Hur, chronicles both the man and the times. It also highlights how the same issues then manifest themselves today. Ben-Hur is genuinely a novel for the ages, and Lew Wallace is a fascinating and extraordinary study. Michael E. Fox was raised in Crawfordsville, Indiana. During childhood, he developed friendships with elderly people who knew the great American author Lew Wallace. Lew wrote 7 of his 8 parts of Ben-Hur in Crawfordsville, and his study and museum is located there. Mr. Fox has had a lifetime interest in 19th century history and has studied extensive books and articles concerning this period, notably Lew Wallace. Welcome, Michael.
Good morning. Thank you, Lawrence.
Oh, catching my breath after that intro.
Yeah.
But, you know, I want to say first, I've also been to Crawfordsville within the last couple of years. Actually, it was last year. I think I shared that with you.
That's correct.
And yes. Visited the study and became a big fan of Lew Wallace, just seeing his study that was on his property. A fascinating little building. I imagine building one of my own pasture up here. That would be so cool. Yeah. To have a Moorish-looking building that had all my books and paintings and, you know, my computer. In my case, I guess he was probably scratching things down on a pad. But, yeah.
Yeah, he had his favorite chair that he usually wrote in, and he would move it out to underneath a large tree.
Yeah.
Outside the, yeah, as well.
So if you would have asked me, you know, a few years back, who wrote Ben-Hur, I would have, and you told me it was a novel from the 1800s, I would have said, nah, that was a novel from the 40s or 50s because, you know, it was a movie in the 50s. But I also, if you would have said who wrote it, I would have, you know, who was Lew Wallace, I would have guessed he was a clergyman. It was probably written by a pastor, someone who was probably trained in that and, you know, wanted to build a religious message into a novel. But Lew Wallace is really not that. He's a very different kind of guy. So a very deep individual, many accomplishments in his life. So why don't we start with Crawfordsville and the connection to Lew and to you and just how you got interested in Lew.
Right. My family moved to Crawfordsville in 1959, and at that time there had been a major recession in the country. My father had lost his job, and he found a new job in Crawfordsville and moved my sister, myself, and my mother there. And it was at the same time that the 1959 version of Ben-Hur was being released. And so it was a very exciting time in town, obviously, and because Lew had written, according to Lew, he had written 7 out of the 8 portions of Ben-Hur in Crawfordsville. And so it was my first time actually going to an indoor theater. Before then, we'd always gone to drive-ins, and the theater was converted from an old traditional theater to a movie theater, and it held quite a few people, and so there was a big crowd, and the curtains would open up, and the movie started. And at 5 years old, I was just enthralled for the next 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
It was just an exciting time for a young boy like myself. And so I was hooked from then on for the rest of my life until today to Lou and his story. And that's how it all got started.
Yeah, I know the whole Circus Maximus chariot race part. That was always fascinating to me. And the whole story of Ben-Hur and the whole movie, of course, you know, it was like a night where sometimes they broke it up into two evenings, part one, part two, that you'd watch it on television. But the I remember going to Italy, and one of the first things I wanted to find in Rome was, where was the Circus Maximus? Where would Ben-Hur have actually been had that happened? And yeah, there's nothing there now except like a field. I don't know if you've ever been to Rome, to that part of the city, but yeah, it's kind of disappointing and really, anticlimactic. Nothing like the movie. Trying to go there today and imagine such a thing.
Yes, that was quite a production. Actually, that part of the movie was subcontracted out to an Italian director and producer, and they built the Colosseum. Basically out of wood, and then we'd cover it with some sort of a stucco, and that's where it was filmed. And it took 5 months to film that part of the of the film, and it was quite this extravaganza, and people don't realize that it was that part of it at least was all filmed in Italy and in Rome.
Yeah, so
it was very interesting.
Yes, yeah. I guess they didn't have CGI back then. You had to actually had to set that set up and do the acting.
Correct. They had to build the facility, put the people in there. They had literally thousands of horses that they used, it was quite the extravaganza just to film that part.
Yeah. So kudos to Wallace in that his story is still resonating in 1959, that they're making it into another Hollywood movie and probably the biggest picture of that year. I don't know if it won the Academy Award. It probably did for at least something. But
that film won 11 Academy Awards.
Yeah.
The 1959 version, yes.
Wow.
It's one of the more successful movies ever produced.
So what year was Ben-Hur released as a novel originally?
It was in 1880, and Lou was territorial governor of New Mexico at the time, and he had gone there in 1878, he spent the next year or so writing the eighth part of it, and then sort of rewriting the entire manuscript again. Mm-hmm. And before he submitted it, and he took some time off to go to Chicago and present it to the publishers, Harper, and then it was printed at the Lakeside Press by R. Donnelly, right there in downtown Chicago.
Okay. Yeah. So one of the weird coincidences about your book and my recent trip where I went to Crawfordsville, my wife and I then went to see my daughter in Pueblo, Colorado. And then we decided to drive back through New Mexico. We went down to Santa Fe, went through there, stayed there, saw a few things, and then down to Billy the Kid's grave, and then home. And like all those things tie into Lou Wallace.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, on that note, Michael, we're going to take our first break. Be right back.
Sunbury Press Books is the home of independent authors and thinkers. Radio Free Press is our imprint for politics and social issues. Check out authors such as Pat LaMarche, author of Still Left Out in America, The State of Homelessness in the United States, Wingnuts, A Field Guide to Everyday Extremism in America by David Michael Slater, and A Year of Change and Consequences by Mark Single. Find out more by clicking the Books tab at sunburypress.com.
I'm back with Michael E. Fox, the author of Lou, The Life and Times of the Author of Ben-Hur. So we've been talking about Lou Wallace, a little bit of jumping around a little bit, and that's my fault. We've got him going from Crawfordsville to New Mexico and back, and talking about the circus magnate. But there's a lot to Lou. Maybe go back to his earlier days and up to the Civil War. What was his education? What was his upbringing?
Yeah, his father had gone to West Point and taught math for a year, and then had left, come back to Indiana, became a lawyer, and he had political aspirations. And so his father moved him, like my father did, at the age of five from Brookville in southeastern Indiana up to northwestern Indiana, 160 miles away. And at that time, his father was elected lieutenant governor. And so Lou had a lot of political connections because his maternal grandfather had also been a congressman. So he had a lot of political influence in his life early on and connections. In fact, William Henry Harrison was a family friend. And William Henry Harrison went on to become the ninth president of the United States for the shortest period known of 31 days before he died of pneumonia.
Tippecanoe and Tyler, too.
Tippecanoe and Tyler, too. And John Tyler was actually a Democrat, and he was a Whig. So it was, mm-hmm. it was an interesting time. And so Lou grew up with all that political influence. His father moved to Crawfordsville a few years later and ran for governor, became governor. And they moved to Indianapolis, where they had just purchased a new home there for the governor. Lou said it was a rather plain but convenient home. It was close to downtown. And Lou quickly became the most often visitor to the state library there and began reading. By that time, he was about 8 years old. In between time, his mother passed away. So he lost his mother and had gained a stepmother from Indianapolis. Her father was a doctor there in Indianapolis, so they had connections there as well. And so he went to a seminary there. He had started school in Covington, but he was always attracted to rivers and woods, and he was very much an outdoorsman type of, and he played truancy quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And so he did it there. He had to endure a lot of corporal punishment up there. His father also dished out a fair amount of corporal punishment. But it didn't seem to ever deter him. He had other interests. And it was either the library or it was the woods and the rivers and the streams would be where he would hang out. And he would feel comfortable. And he also had a very strange ability to quickly create friendships with older men. And even though he had friends his own age, he seemed to have this, he seemed to be way beyond his years in that way. And older men liked spending time with him. And he would spend time with a guy who ran a ferry across the river, and then some time with a farmer who would let him use his canoe on the Sugar Creek near Crawfordsville, and then later Mr. Jacob Cox, who was an artist, and Lou started learning to paint and draw from Jacob Cox in Indianapolis, and then later on the county clerk whom he worked for, and they became big buddies, and they went out, and Lou loved to hunt, and had become a crack shot when he was in Crawfordsville because he lived on a farm for a little while, and they found out that he was so good at hunting that they provided, instead of making him work around the farm, they gave him a rifle and plenty of ammunition to go out and kill fresh game. Wow. That was always the way he was, but at the same time, he was also intellectual, and he was signed up into a seminary in Indianapolis, and began more formal schooling and got a little more serious about education at that point in time.
So how does he end up an officer in the Civil War?
So he's the Mexican-American War came along, and there had been a Black Hawk War that his father had been involved in, and he got really interested in military confrontations at that time. And so when the Mexican-American War came up, he, at the age of 19 years old, he opened up his own recruiting station and recruited an entire company of men within only a few days. And they made him a second lieutenant. He served in the Mexican-American War as a second lieutenant. When he got out, he continued on with local militias in Crawfordsville. He started a militia called the Montgomery Guards, and they started imitating the Algerian French Zouaves.
Okay.
And they actually wore their uniforms, and Lou would study all the different infantry tactics and things of the Algerian French Zouaves, and that's how he taught the Montgomery Ward, Montgomery Guards, and they would. Started performing all over. Fort Sumner was fired upon. The governor at the time, who had become a good friend of Lew Wallace's, Oliver P. Morton, called him up and asked him to be his adjutant general and to start recruiting people into the military for Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, who had put out a request to for them to have 75,000 men trained, and that's how Lou started. And then, but he never wanted to be adjutant general. He wanted to have a field command. So he asked Morton if he could have a field command, and Morton gave him a regiment, which was known as the 11th Indiana Regiment at the time. And he proceeded to war from there. That's how it all got started for him.
Wow. What did he think of McClellan?
He didn't know McClellan very well. He was sort of lower on the... He was really under Grant mm-hmm. almost from day one.
Okay.
And Grant was under Halleck, Henry Halleck,
yep.
who was the commander of the Western Theater at the time.
Yeah.
And by the time Lou got to a higher level, McClellan, of course, had moved on.
Yep.
And was actually, you know... considering running against Abraham Lincoln, which he did for the election in 1864. So that's how Lou progressed. He I know he didn't think much of Grant. He did had a lot of respect for a Charles F. Smith, who became, when Grant was relieved of duty after Fort Donelson, because Henry Halleck could not find Grant for days afterwards. So he relieved Grant of his command and put Charles F. Smith in charge. And by that time, Charles F. Smith, who was a graduate of West Point, had already been in the military for 30 years.
Mm.
And Lou just idolized the guy. And unfortunately, he cut his leg on a rusty part of a rowboat and died 10 years later, or 10 days later, of tetanus. And so he was lost, and Halleck was forced to put Grant back in that position again. If Charles F. Smith had survived, the Ulysses S. Grant we know today may never have actually existed.
Wow. Wow, that is fascinating. On that note, we'll be right back.
Sunbury Press Books brings you the history of Pennsylvania. Check out Lancaster's Golden Century, 1821 to 1921 by H.M.J. Kline, Donald Kent's The French Invasion of Western Pennsylvania, or the Keystone Tombstone series written by Joe Farrell and Joe Farley. Click on the Books tab at sunburypress.com and find works of history, fiction, and nonfiction from the Keystone State.
I'm back with Michael E. Fox, the author of Lou. So, Lew Wallace, Civil War, is it during the Grant administration that he gets the assignment to New Mexico?
No, actually it was...
Hayes?
I think it was Hayes, yeah. Yes, because he had helped Hayes with his election the year before, because there was a a discrepancy and a controversy in the presidential election in Florida.
Yeah.
And they had to go and recount, something that we know in modern times also has occurred. And so Lou was asked to go down there and represent Hayes in the recounting, and then also to go in front of the Board of Governors, who actually decided who got the electoral votes. And he was able to successfully argue that. So Hayes felt that he owed Lou something for that. And so he first offered him to go to Bolivia as the ambassador, and Lou turned it down. And then 2 weeks later, he offered New Mexico, and Lou took that. And he had an affinity for Mexico, and he had studied Spanish most of his life. And so that was more attractive to him than going all the way to South America with his family.
Wow.
So that's how he got there.
Yeah. Wow. So there's we've covered a lot of his life and a very little bit about Ben-Hur. But the premise of your biography is that a lot about Ben-Hur is really about Lou. So maybe tie a couple of these things. Of course, we want everybody to read the book, but don't want to give it all away.
Correct.
But what were a couple of the key points that are similar to Ben-Hur, the story of Ben-Hur that probably more people are familiar with than the story of Lou Wallace?
Yeah, Lou had developed a bad reputation after Shiloh for something that occurred, that most of which was not his fault, but Grant was reeling from it because, again, it was a controversial sort of stalemate, actually. And Lou had this dark cloud over his head because of something that had happened at Shiloh. And he starts Ben-Hur out very similarly in that Rome had announced this man, Gratus, by the name of Gratus, to take over Judea for Rome. And Lou just happened to be with his sister on top of their house, and he knocked a tile and it fell on Gratus. Well, Gratus, I think, very much is a symbol for Grant. And Grant, or Gratus, if you will, sent Lou to the gallows. And so that was kind of the way Lou felt when he lost his command after Shiloh, that he had been sent to the gallows or sent. He actually yelled at Governor Morton, you know, "You've put me on the shelf. You've put me away." And they never had good relationships after that. And I think Morton was a symbol for Messala, who was also a childhood friend of his in Ben-Hur, who was really actually the one who arrested him and put him in chains and shut down the home or the house of Ben-Hur and sent his sister and his mother to prison.
Right.
And then Lou had to spend a few years on a galley ship. And so as you go through it, you see these same characters and these same things happening that happened to Lou in his lifetime. So it became very clear to me that early on that Ben-Hur was really a lightly veiled reliving of Lou's life that he was getting out on paper.
Writing what he knew, huh?
Writing what he knew, yeah. Putting those feelings into this book. And people see it as a religious book. And yes, I think at some point, maybe Lou had an epiphany as he went along, and but he was careful not to put Jesus Christ too much in the book, because publishers at the time did not want that, because every time someone would write a book like that, people would take offense to it, that someone was trying to write about God or Jesus Christ, and they really felt like that was up to the church, to the Bible, to their ministers to do. And so they rejected it. So Lou was careful. In fact, he did not even mention Jesus Christ in the book in Ben-Hur. When you read it, he talks about him as the man from Nazarene.
Right.
To try to sidestep that whole issue.
So the novel back in 1880, 1881, too, those early years, it sold very well, did it not?
It was the number one best-selling book from 1880, I think, until 1935, when Gone with the Wind was published.
Wow.
And that's like 54 years.
Now,
the number one selling book.
Did Lou reap the benefits of that? Was there a lot of money?
He did, but then Lou had a problem with money, and he would spend a lot of his money and spend money that he didn't have. And finally, when his son reached an age of where after he had gone to college, his son came back and took over his finances, and then Lou started to do much better. So he was really the consummate artistic man that... He was never good at math, and he was never good at finances.
Yeah.
And so it was interesting. His son ran his life financially through most of his life up until the time that he passed away.
Well, having toured his study and the museum recently, I would say I was very impressed with realizing that he was a novelist, a writer. Of course, he was a biographer, too, because he wrote Benjamin Harrison's biography, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
And also a painter, and I saw some of his artwork in his study. Pretty good as a painter, a realist, more portraiture, that kind of thing. And
correct.
I'm thinking he's also the architect of his study. Certainly they wouldn't have built something that he didn't design or at least conceive, so... You think about the multiple intelligences that Lou had and the fact that he was constantly being punished as a child, was probably extremely bright, hyperactive, the creative type.
And, right. He was very difficult to control. In fact, at one point, his father sent him away to a school in Centerville to a man by the name of Hossauer, who was well known as a teacher there, and Oliver P. Morton actually was taught by him as well. And that was, Lou always pointed that out as a turning point in his life, that Hossauer really got him focused on education and got him disciplined and helped him from that point forward to move his life in a very positive direction.
Yeah. Based on what I saw at a study, I'm guessing he was a Mason as well.
Yes. Yes, he was. He liked to draw, and so he did a lot of the initial drawings for the library, and then he had local masons, build the structure, and it was quite unique at the time because it was all made of stone and brick, which was not normal at the time, especially in Crawfordsville. Maybe
yeah.
In New York, but not so much in the Midwest.
I almost imagined that I was going to a treasure trove for a Knights Templar who was exiled to Indiana from the Middle Ages. It was a pretty cool place. Well, Michael, I was going to say, we're just about out of time. You were going to say?
I was just going to say, yeah, I think someone told me one time, they said if they ever saw Lou riding a horse down the middle of the street with armor on, no one would be surprised.
Right, definitely. So, closing comments here, Michael. Any feedback on the book so far, or anything going on with it?
So far, the feedback's been very positive. I gave a presentation at the Palm Desert Library last week that went very well. Actually, had two people show up from Crawfordsville.
Wow,
One of the ladies was a daughter of the doctor that delivered my oldest son. So it's a small world, after all, as they say.
Indeed. Well, Michael, it's been great talking to you.
I appreciate all that Sunbury Press has done for me as well.
Thank you for listening to the Sunbury Press Book Show on the BookSpeak Network. Check out our website at www.sunburypress.com for our latest releases. Be sure to subscribe to our newsletter to receive special offers and discounts.